From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And we begin today with another candidate for Congress. Joshua Lloyd is the Republican nominee for the 13th District, which is currently represented by first-term Democratic Congresswoman Nikki Budzinski. It's a district that was redrawn a few years ago to give Democrats an advantage, running from the college towns of Champaign-Urbana, west through Decatur and Springfield, and then south to the area known as Metro East, the Illinois portion of the St. Louis metropolitan area. We aired our interview with Congresswoman Budzinski back on October 9th, and you can find that on our website, 21stshow.org. But today, we begin with Joshua Lloyd. He's 26 years old, he lives in Verdon, Illinois, south of Springfield, and he won a contested primary for the Republican nomination. Most of Lloyd's adult life was spent in the Army. He enlisted out of high school and was assigned to duty in Central and Southern Illinois.
I did military funeral honors full time, so I was the one playing the bugle, folding the flag, and presenting it to the next of kin.
But Lloyd had higher ambitions for military life. Both his parents are career officers. He says he knew he wanted to follow in their footsteps at a young age.
I sent West Point a letter at 9. They were very kind enough to send me back a brochure of West Point, which I carried around with me from the day that I received it.
After 2 years as an enlisted man, Lloyd was accepted to the U.S. Military Academy and became a cadet. But his goal of becoming an Army officer was not to be.
Yeah, when I was enlisted, I had an injury. At the time, it wasn't anything to be worried about. But once I get through West Point, during the final process, right before commissioning, they realized that my injury had progressed to a point where I couldn't perform certain military activities to the standard. So instead of just kicking me out right then and there from the military, they allowed me to at least graduate from West Point and finish out the academic program there. But ultimately, the general, his name is General Williams, he decided to honorably discharge me from the military after graduation.
Which mostly brings us to the present day and Lloyd's campaign to represent the 13th District in Congress. I spoke with Joshua Lloyd on Friday afternoon and began by asking why he was running.
I originally started my campaign because I was having difficulties with the Department of Veterans Affairs. So after I got out of the military, I was trying to get serviced through the VA. And I was just having such a difficult time through the entire process. And ultimately, they always tell you, contact your congressman, contact your senator. And so that's ultimately what I did. After 6 months of no response from the VA, I contacted my congressional representatives. And even then, I still couldn't receive any email, any phone call back. And just getting out of a career, and I have no financial obligations, my wife and I decided that since I have an active interest in politics and I know what's going on in a global scale, that this would probably be the best opportunity, best chance for me to actually put my foot into the ring and try to represent the people of Illinois.
From there, I moved on to asking Lloyd about policy issues, beginning with abortion and reproductive health care. I just want to start by asking you, as I asked your opponent a couple of weeks ago, when do you think life begins?
I definitely believe that life begins at conception. But with that said, when people talk about abortion, they always bring up the term women's choice or women's health. When it ultimately comes down to it, abortion happens at 92% with an elective abortion rate. So essentially what that means is 92% of abortions are by choice. It's not because rape, incest, or the life of the mother. It's just purely the choice of the mother not to have a child. They're using it as a form of birth control.
What is your source for that statistic? I heard you give this to another interviewer as well.
I believe that's from the National Institute of Health, but I can double check my source and get back to you.
Well, I found something on that that was from the Lozier Institute, which is a pro-life think tank advocacy organization. And they had this claim that, in fact, for them, they said 96% of abortions are for, quote, elective and unspecified reasons. And I just want to provide the context that, at least from their number, that data is based on 8 states, which constitute an estimated 13% of American abortions. And they acknowledge some of the limitations with their sort of data process. A lot of women elect not to give a reason for an abortion, and they still put that in the elective category. So I guess my question to you is, bigger picture here, 63% of Americans say abortion should be legal in all or most cases. 36% say it should be illegal in all or most cases. Regardless of, you know, when people believe life begins, that's what they think the law should be. Your perspective is it's a minority one in America. Why should it carry the day?
Yeah. So when I originally started this campaign, I was more along that line as well. And I acknowledged early on, pre-primary, that I was more along the lines of the state or the federal government should not be involved at all. But as the campaign progressed and the more people I talked to and the more organizations I spoke to, it came to my attention and my understanding that about 80 to 90% of women, after they have an abortion, they feel lifelong regret, and they feel some form of longing to have that child. But with that said, 92% of this demographic that said that 5 years down the road, they also said that at the time, it was the right choice for them. So even though they have this regret and this longing, some of them still say that it was the best choice for them at the time. That's not saying that if they had a child, their life would be over or ruined. And it just, to me, it is, when it's an elective, it is having an abortion just so you don't have to deal with that responsibility, don't have to deal with that financial burden, or don't have to cope with having to raise another life. And to me, it's sort of a punishment for the child because of a instance that happened in the past.
What this though comes down to though is policy. And there is talk of a national standard. We used to have one in place through the Supreme Court and their Roe versus Wade decision. Obviously that was overturned 2 years ago. What should a cutoff be if sure there should be one, when a woman could choose to have an abortion? Is it 15 weeks? Is it 6 weeks as some states have done, or never?
Well, I can tell you from speaking with numerous Republican officials, numerous federal congressional Republican officials, there will not be a federal abortion ban. And that's just not going to happen with this Congress, the next Congress, or the Congress after that. There is no plan to implement a national abortion ban.
Would you vote for one if there was, if somebody changed their mind and introduced one down the line?
There won't be, because it'll die within the committee.
But would you vote for it if it were?
That's just not something any congressional candidate wants to deal with. No sitting congressman or any candidate.
And what if it turns out the other way? Let's say there's a Democratic Congress and they want to pass a law that says you can't ban it before 15 weeks. You know, where would you put the cutoff in that case?
We've already settled this with the post-Roe law. It's set to the states. It's not with the federal government anymore.
What about birth control? Should that be something that the federal government should regulate or restrict, or should that be legal across the country?
That should definitely be legal across the country. There's no reason to take away birth control or contraceptives away from women who are planning for their future. They are taking the proper and necessary steps to ensure that they don't have an unwanted pregnancy.
All right, let me reintroduce this conversation. If you're just joining us, we are listening to my interview with Joshua Lloyd, who is the Republican nominee for the 13th Congressional District. He's facing Nikki Budzinski, whom we spoke to on the program a couple of weeks ago. We next moved on to talking about issues related to the border and immigration. What would you change about America's border policy?
So there's several factors to this. So one is the entire influx of immigration right now from the southern border. So when we look at immigration, there's two factors. There's the legal factor and there's the illegal factor. What we need to stop right now is the illegal factors. The individuals coming to the United States in caravans or in large groups through the southern border, illegally, undocumented, and with no necessary plan for the future. You see some states even rewarding the individuals coming to the United States illegally. You have Illinois and New York providing preloaded debit cards with money on it you have hotels, you have food stamps, you have housing, you have all these luxuries that many Americans can't even receive right now. But we are providing it to undocumented and illegal immigrants. So with that said, we need to stop that the influx from the southern border. At the same time, there is a backlog within the immigration system. So the individuals who did apply to come to the United States legally and through their proper channels, they keep getting pushed back within the system because the immigration system now has to deal with all these immigrants already here and trying to apply for either sanctuary or American status. We need to help these government agencies process this paperwork so we can allow the immigrants who want to come to the United States legally and through the proper channels can come here so they can work, so they can go to school, so they can be with their families. I was talking with one individual the other day. He said his family applied almost 10 years ago. They got a notification 5 years ago that that they had a meeting with the embassy in order to go through the final process, through their interview process. But that interview keeps getting pushed out. So instead of receiving their interview 2.5 years ago like they were supposed to, so they received notification 5 years ago, the interview was supposed to be 2.5 years ago. Now they are still pushed back another 6 years because of the backlog.
So there is a huge backlog. A lot of the people you mentioned, the people who have been bused to New York and Chicago and elsewhere, often because they show up in Texas, not through a legal border crossing. They're crossing the Rio Grande or what have you. And yet they are here to claim asylum and say that they are persecuted in their home country. Should America not be granting asylum to people or considering asylum claims anymore? Or how do you think of that?
It's not the claim of asylum. It's just we have such a lax rule on what asylum actually means. So many of these immigrants coming through the southern border unauthorized, they're just coming from a country with very limited resources, very poor nations in South and Central America. And they are just coming here so they can receive some of the benefits that we have in the United States. So when you speak about asylum, you know, a lot of times you think of somewhere that's had a previous war. So somewhere possibly Ukraine or the Middle East or some nations in Africa. So my roommate at West Point, he was actually from Rwanda, and he was Tutsi, meaning his family was the one actually being persecuted against. There just wasn't enough process for them to actually come to the United States for that asylum. But now that we have such a loose system here in the United States, now anyone can come here and claim asylum. What does asylum actually mean?
So too loose, I guess, is what you're saying in the way we define it now. What about the so-called dreamers, the people who were brought here as children? They often have greater connections to America than their parents' home countries. Our Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin has been very involved in this issue for many years now. They've been in legal limbo for more than a decade. What should happen with them?
So in my eyes, they are American. They grew up in the United States, and they should not be punished for the sins of their father or mother, right? Even though they quote unquote are illegally in the United States, they had no control over that. They didn't have a choice in the matter. They came here because they were essentially forced to. And so in my eyes, they are Americans. You can call them dreamers. I'll call them Americans.
Let's also talk about firearms. Guns are obviously a huge issue in American politics. Would you support or oppose restrictions on what some people call assault weapons, military-style weapons? You know what I'm talking about when we talk about this.
I would oppose any and all legislation that has to do anything with firearms. All the firearm regulation that's on the books right now is unconstitutional. That's what it is. It's completely unconstitutional, and it goes against the rights of every American.
Should we have open carry?
Assault weapons?
Like when you say
yeah.
An open carry in Illinois, if you want, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And police would like that too, because at that point, they can understand if a person is armed or unarmed, so they know if they need to take precautions or not.
50 caliber weapons, grenade launchers. Would you have any restrictions on weaponry that Americans could obtain and possess?
No. People talk about all the gun crime and everything. Look, So 48,000 deaths in the United States. That's what the CDC is claiming. 48,000 deaths by firearms in the United States. 54% of that was suicide. And as we know, regardless if they had a firearm or not, right? If they made their choice for suicide, then they would have done it by other means. So now we're at roughly
I
20,
think some people
20,000.
might contest that and say that it's easier to use a firearm than something that's a little more difficult to do than pulling a trigger, right?
Yeah, and if you look at the data, men are more likely to use firearms, whereas women's are more likely to use something such as cutting or pills, right? But that doesn't change the fact that suicide happened before weapons were even invented. And it will continue happening even if all the weapons are banned. And the most dangerous cities in the United States are the cities with the most restrictions on firearms. Criminals don't care about firearm restrictions. Only the law-abiding citizens do. And at that point, you are just taking away their right for self-defense.
All right, we need to take a break. We will continue hearing from Joshua Lloyd, the Republican nominee in the 13th Congressional District. He is challenging Democrat Nikki Budzinski, whom we interviewed on the show a couple of weeks ago. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to my interview with Joshua Lloyd. He's the Republican nominee for the 13th Congressional District in Central Illinois, facing incumbent Democratic Congresswoman Nikki Budzinski. I do want to spend some time as well on foreign affairs. That is a big part of what the Congress deals with. What, if anything, would you change about America's role in the Russia-Ukraine war?
Right now, nothing.
Nothing. Do you think the Biden administration has largely done the right things in consultation with the Congress?
Biden administration, no. But in terms of Congress, yes. Providing the necessary infrastructure in order to wage the conflict is necessary. And we're actually seeing some of the benefits from that. So there's factories in Pennsylvania producing the artillery shells necessary in Ukraine. You see the conflict kind of like a test ground for different tactics that the military has been thinking about, but never has actually implemented. So they're trying out their new theories, seeing what works, and this will actually benefit the United States in the unfortunate instance we were pulled into a larger conflict.
Back in April, Illinois' three Republican members of Congress were divided in how they voted on legislation that approved more funding for weapons for Ukraine. Darren LaHood voted for it. Mike Bost and Mary Miller voted against it. How would you have voted on that legislation?
I would have voted for it. So we've already started providing that aid. And to all of a sudden pull out would essentially signal to the world that, you know, America is not a responsible partner for any conflict, that we can't be relied on.
I do want to touch on one other foreign affairs issue, and that has to do with Israel. Your opponent in this campaign, Nikki Budzinski, has been the subject of protests and pushback from some of her constituents over her support for Israel. I wonder, how would your stance differ toward Israel, if at all, from hers?
A lot of people have the speculation that the war is between Israel and Hamas, one of the political parties of Palestine. But as the more information that comes out, we learn that it's not a war between Israel and Palestine or Israel and Hamas. It's a proxy war between Israel and Iran. Iran is funding these various groups in order to attack Israel because they don't like the Jewish state. But when it comes down to it, they weren't protesting Nikki because they necessarily disagreed with her policy. They were protesting her because she wouldn't even have a sit down or a conversation with individuals. And once they had the protest, they contacted me and I drove 2.5 hours to Champaign. And I had that sit down. I had that discussion. I talked about the war, the policies, and I talked about just war theory. So within just war theory, there's several different factors that play into it. There's discrimination against combatant and civilian, there's proportionality, and then there's jus ad bello, jus in bello, and jus post bello, which is justice before war, during war, and after war. So after the war, it's the rebuilding, the restructuring, how we're going to support the nations that were in the conflict, and how we can rebuild the nation.
I think there are a lot of people who would say that after what happened on October 7th, Israel had a cause for a just war, right? 1,200 people, many of them civilians, were massacred. couple hundred more were taken hostage. But at this point, more than a year later, tens of thousands of civilians have been killed in Gaza, with many more wounded, and even more still facing starvation. I'm sure you heard about that from the people you said you met with. How do you feel about that? And should America be pressuring Israel to do more to minimize harm to civilians?
So you talk about the attack on October 7th. That's called Jus ad bello, so justice before war, or the reasons to get into conflict. And that was definitely justified. But when it comes to the civilians and the conflict now, I don't believe the embargo against Palestine is absolutely necessary. I understand they're trying to essentially...
The embargo keeping energy, food, water, fuel, that sort of thing out, you're saying. Okay.
Right. Because that not only affects the combatants, which is the intended purpose, but it also affects the civilians, the children, the mothers, the fathers who are there and don't want any purpose to do with Hamas. So the people who are just there because that's where they grew up, that's where they live, that's where they're born.
I want to, as we're coming to the end of our time together, I want to talk about some bigger picture ideas about governance and being a representative. I heard you tell another interviewer that you see yourself as a sort of no-compromise politician. Talk about that.
So I don't see any reason to compromise. If every single time you do compromise, those individuals try to take a mile. You know, you might give an inch here, but they ultimately chain you down and pull you a mile down the road. And when it comes to governance like that, if an individual is willing to compromise and compromise on both sides, then that can be more acceptable than dealing with the individuals who will always stab you in the back in the end. So you just got to understand who you're talking to and what their end goal is. It's like guns, right? So they always talk about this legislation here, this legislation here. It's common sense is their big key word. And a lot of this is not common sense. And they just throw that word in there to make it sound appealing. But their end goal is more nefarious. They're implementing brick by brick a certain legislation wall so that their opposition can't pull the resources or put the legislation in that they want to get through. So if Republicans are going to compromise, it can't be with the individuals in the Democratic Party who are going to stab us in the back.
I do want to go before we end. A question I ask every candidate who's out, at least on the Republican side, who won the 2020 presidential election and was it free and fair?
Well, we see Joe Biden in the White House right now, so that would clearly mean that he won the 2020 presidential election.
And do you think it was free? Do you think he freely and fairly won it? And, you know, aside from this case here and that case there, that it was a largely fair election?
I really don't know where my opinion stands on that anymore, just because of all the conflicting information. I like to get all my information before I form a opinion on it. And if information isn't there correctly, if it's so skewed and so biased, you know, let me put it like this.
It's been 4 years. It was 4 years ago that this happened. There's been a lot of time to gather information.
Yeah, but all the information is being skewed in some way or another. But what I should say is he's in the White House and he won the presidential election. Let me put it like that. But people are still worried about the elections even going forward. So the real question is, how do we calm those fears? How do we go forward from here, right? How do we make sure that elections do happen properly and fair? How do we make sure that the confidence in the elections happen?
Would you have voted to certify the election results on January 6th or what became January 7th, 2021?
I would have.
You would have. So you would have voted with Darren LaHood and Rodney Davis and Adam Kinzinger, but not the way that Mike Boston and Mary Miller voted on that day.
Yes.
Last thing, there has been a significant long-term decline in trust in American society. We don't trust each other. We don't trust our institutions. What do you think is behind that? And what would you see as your role as a member of Congress to try and repair that?
I think just the failure of transparency people want to know what's going on, and they don't like the delay or the conflicting information that they are provided. And that's what I was going back to, why it was hard for me to come up with a solid opinion on the issue. It's because there's so much information out there, but you don't know what is necessarily reliable. And if it is reliable, if it's biased or if it's not biased, people don't want to have all this conflicting information. So if someone wants an opinion, I encourage them to give me a call. My number is 618-417-7336. And just ask me. I will give you a very clear and very straight answer.
Just to be clear, you want that on the radio? You're okay with that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Joshua Lloyd, thank you for sharing your views with us on the 21st show.
Brian, thank you very much.
Joshua Lloyd is the Republican nominee for the 13th Congressional District in Central Illinois. It includes the communities of Champaign-Urbana, Decatur, Springfield, and the Metro East. Our interview with his opponent, incumbent Democratic Congresswoman Nikki Budzinski, aired 2 weeks ago. You can find it on our website, 21stshow.org.